It's time to step into the Coming Out Lounge, a cool, safe space to be true to your sexual self, with your host, Rick Clemens. Rick has helped hundreds of people come out of the closet, and now each week he's bringing you cool insights for loving and accepting yourself, boosting your self-confidence, and living a guilt-free, purpose-filled life on the other side of the closet doors. Cuddle up with yourself and get ready for heartwarming coming out stories, ideas for living authentically, and tips for being fully self-expressed. Now here's your host, Coming Out Coach Rick.
Welcome, Closet Busters, to another edition of the Coming Out Lounge, where we step out, step up, and step into living our powerful truth. Now, sometimes you're called to the music, called to the voice, called to the speaking. And some call it your soul speaking to yourself. And others say it's your calling. And then there are those who say we simply just dance to our own frickin' beat. Yep, that's the music of our lives that I like to call dancing to the beat, especially our gay lives. That seems like music helps us really sing and dance in our own way into our gay skin. And you might even sometimes look at it as you're coming out of the closet and into your gay life or lesbian life, bisexual, transgender life, whatever it may be for you, as stepping into a whole new remix. And I think that's pretty cool when we can step into those areas of life and have the music come alive. So today we're going to drop some tracks with a pretty cool guy who actually is a master remixer. He's a music guy. He's a DJ. His name is Matt Consola. And he's going to help us find our song, our beat, our high notes of our LGBTQ life and in our world as LGBTQ individuals. So let's bring Matt right into the podcast. Welcome, Matt.
Hello.
Thank you. I'm so excited to have you here. And I've been checking out all your good stuff, and I just felt like this is a pretty cool way to talk about coming out and really being who you are, because I think music has a huge influence on us, not only as humans, but especially as we go through these tough times of trying to find ourselves and then celebrating who we are as we come through those closet doors. Really excited to be having this conversation. So let's kind of step into your life and what you do and where you came from. So let's maybe go back to what was life like when you were stepping into finding yourself, maybe not only professionally, but in yourself as an individual. What was kind of the journey like for you?
It was kind of difficult. You know, I was born in New York, but we moved out to California at a fairly young age. And my parents put us three kids into private school. So my older brother and I went to all boys school, Catholic run, and then Jesuit high school. And then my brother went on to Jesuit college. I stopped and went to local college. But definitely being raised Catholic and not practicing anymore certainly delayed me coming out.
Yeah.
I didn't really come out until probably my sophomore year in college. Mm-hmm. I was still kind of hanging on, you know, let me just try one more girlfriend sort of thing, even though nothing was happening between us. I just kind of had that religious guilt in the back of my head until I couldn't not bust out of the closet.
Yeah. Talk to me a little bit about that religious guilt, because I always love having that piece of the conversation to get people's different perspective. Because I think for each of us, it's similar, but yet there's always something unique about that guilt piece. So what did that feel like for you?
The funny thing is, you know, growing up in, again, going to a Catholic school and going to a Jesuit-run high school, I can't ever remember ever hearing the word gay or the term gay is wrong or anything like that. I just don't ever remember the word gay ever coming up in church or in, you know, religious class or whatever. It was just something that just wasn't spoken about, period. Mm-hmm. So I'm not even sure how I got it into my head that they considered it to be a bad thing, a wrong thing. But eventually, I think just society, you know, slowly it just seeps into you from TV and movies and whatnot. And I remember slowly trying to act on my deep down feelings and being scared about it at the same time.
Sure. But here's something interesting, Matt. And I think this is something that has only come up, I want to say maybe one other time in almost 100 episodes of this podcast, is that little silent piece. Even if they're not saying anything about it, and they being, you know, whether it's your Catholic school or family or whatever, even if it's not being talked about, that's almost as damaging as it constantly being talked about of you can't be this, because it's almost like we're not going to address this. It's just not going to be part of the conversation.
Yeah, I think now if that were to happen, because the LGBT community is, you know, in the forefront right now, and it's a topic that if a school were to do that, there would be issues because a lot of kids are now coming out much, much younger.
Yep.
And are having much less resistance coming out. I think for me, it was sort of, you know, I was an altar boy while I was in elementary school.
Yep.
And so, I mean, I had to listen to the whole friggin' Bible be discussed every weekend.
Sure.
And I just don't remember any of those passages coming up about, you know, it being wrong where I would have to think to myself, well, I think I'm gay, so I guess maybe I'm wrong. I don't really know when it seeped into my brain that they considered it to be wrong. But at the same time, I knew I had to hide it. And my two best friends in high school were all gay, came out a little sooner than I did. Like I said, I kind of pushed it through college. I was in a fraternity, so that made things a little difficult. But once sophomore year hit, I was just like, I can't do this anymore. I'm more and more being attracted to men, and I finally need to act on it.
Yeah. So I hate this question, but it always kind of helps give some perspective to listeners, because we have listeners from, first, all over the world that listen to this, and all different age ranges as well. So what's that earliest recollection that you really have of knowing, hey, there's something different about me?
I remember it very clearly. It's funny that I have such fairly clear memories from being a really young child, but probably around 4 or 5.
Yeah.
My father, who was a civil engineer, used to have a lot of his coworkers, like, we'll park at our house and then they'd all take one vehicle to work because, again, he was a civil engineer. And I remember just having a huge crush on one of his coworkers. Yeah. At a very young age. You know, never spoke about it, obviously couldn't act upon it. But yeah, it was just, that's probably my earliest, is probably around 4 or 5 years old.
Yeah. I think that's about the time that I remember it as well. And then I had some other situations come up where I talk about this somewhat on the show from time to time. And I don't consider it child molestation, but I do have someone who took my sexual energy away from me at a very young age. And that kind of confirmed everything for me. It's like, oh, okay, now I get why I've had all these feelings. And then it kind of got brushed under the carpet once again as I started to go into preteen, teen life, you know, high school, all that. Yet I knew what I felt, but I wasn't 100% sure, because in my case, then that's when the religious stuff started to really show up and the messages started to get sent of, oh, you can't be this. This is a sin, so on and so forth. So you come out in your sophomore year.
I can say, thankfully, my parents were pretty supportive.
Yep.
By the time I came out, you know, mom, who worked for the state and in California at the time, and, you know, if you were going to be leaving the country and need to get your shots for immunization or for traveling overseas, she was a woman you had to see if you lived anywhere in Northern California.
Yeah, right.
So her and her friends used to, you know, go to the local Hamburger Mary's every Wednesday for hamburgers. And once her kid was out, then suddenly she had, you know, even more reason to go there and have her favorite hamburger at the gay restaurant. It was all of a sudden, it was kind of exciting for her. My dad, who's quite the intellectual and almost became a priest at one time before leaving the seminary and deciding to learn all he could about world religions, but at the same time being agnostic. So he definitely taught us to kind of question everything in the same way that going to Jesuit high school, you're always taught to question everything. Don't take everything on blind faith, which is so opposite how you're taught being, you know, a Christian or being Catholic, where you're supposed to take everything on blind faith. So,
absolutely.
You know, so dad, it was a little more difficult for my father because he just, I don't think he was really expecting it. And my sister told me there were a few times where she had heard him cry in the bedroom. But for the most part, they got over it pretty quickly and were very accepting with the people, you know, I was dating. I mean, you know, of course, you always had that first conversation. Are you sure it's not a phase?
Of course.
That, again, mostly came from dad. You know, they've been very supportive about all of it. What struck them more was I'm 48 years old. I have been HIV positive more than half my life now, which is kind of odd. They had a harder time with the HIV positive than they did with me being gay. And on top of it, I had had an operation on my throat in college. Tonsillitis, adenitis had gotten out of control. And I actually became positive through blood transfusion.
Oh, really? Wow.
At a time when they were still trying to figure out how to do all the blood stuff.
Sure.
So what was kind of upsetting to me was like, I haven't even had sex yet, and I already tested HIV positive.
So that's a biggie. I mean, yeah. How did you come through those woods yourself? I mean,
that was
a big blow.
It was a huge blow. I had already had my best friend was positive and had been for a few years. So that sort of helped. But yeah, you freak out for that first 6 months or a year. And at the time, they're like, well, the doctor's like, well, don't tell anybody. Keep it to yourself. Only tell it to family members and only tell the people who you think you should know. And now I think that was really bad advice because I think I would have come through it faster had I spoken about
it. This is probably what, early 90s that you're going through this?
Yeah. When did the Longtime Companion come out?
About that time. Yeah. There was still a lot of uncertainty about really what was going on.
The
epidemic. I mean, it wasn't at the earliest stages, but they were still like, okay, where they were trying to figure out everything about it that they could and whether it was.
At most, it was AZT and 3TC, I think. And I had several friends all within like a 2 or 3 month period. I probably went to 8 or 9 funerals of people who literally looked perfectly fine 3 months ago and were dead 3 months later. So I just assumed, hey, I'm going to be dead in a few months. I'm just going to try to do all the things I really want to do. And I just got lucky that I've stayed healthy, never got an opportunistic infection, with the exception of 1 year later, I got non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which cancer does run in my family. And I was at the correct age that if you're going to get it, I was at the correct age. So that freaked me out even more because that would bring my T cell count under 200 going through chemo.
Sure.
But once I finished 6 months of chemo, I've been clear for 20 some odd years. My count's back up to normal levels, and I'm on one of those one pill a day things and don't really even think about it. It doesn't control my life or rule my life the way it used to in the beginning. I mean, every day you woke up wondering if this is going to be your last day or if you're going to get sick, and you're making plans to do little things just in case you're not going to be able to do them any longer. Yep. And now I don't even think about it. I take my pill at night along with my vitamins and I go on with my life. Mm-hmm. It's not the death sentence it used to be.
Right. So I would imagine, I hate to make the assumption, but I'm going to go ahead and just put it in the realm of imagining that you have been through a lot of the ups and downs, not only with society as a whole, but in our own community, of the stigma that comes along with being HIV positive.
Sure. I mean, San Francisco is pretty much the Logan's Run bubble. We definitely didn't have it as bad. Probably, San Francisco, LA, New York probably didn't have it as bad as the whole rest of the country. Mm-hmm. I knew more people who were positive than weren't. So there was definitely a bigger support group of people in San Francisco. Unfortunately, just a lot of people were passing away. And of course, it made, dating in the beginning much more difficult.
Yep.
And I just decided quite a long time ago, I'm only going to date other HIV positive people. Mm-hmm. It's just going to make life easier that way. And that was until very recent.
Yeah. Well, I can personally relate to this. I'm not positive, but I came out to my parents when I was 19. Shortly thereafter, my dad's oldest brother, who was gay, contracted the virus. So we're talking very early, like 82, 83, when this was just really starting to hit.
Sure.
And we lost him very quickly because they didn't know what's going on. So I can definitely relate to this feeling of, okay, wow, this stigma thing. And kind of stayed in touch a little bit with his partner at the time. And then I went back in the closet because this was part of the, you can't be this, you're going to go get help and da, 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 da. And I guess for me, it probably...
What part of the country were you in?
California.
California.
Actually, I was in Oklahoma at the time, but most of the family was here in California. My uncle lived in San Francisco. So I remember just feeling like, okay, well, maybe this is a sign I'm not really who I think I am. And then when we lost him, and then I went through some religious counseling and then kind of said, okay, maybe this just is a phase. And so I went that route. I mean, I really literally went that route. I hate to use the term thankful, but that's the only way I can say it is I'm thankful that that's the route I went through because I was pretty naive. I was not a sexually active, college guy at all. And I think if I had gotten that urge to be out and go that route, I probably would have been pretty stupid because I didn't know enough. I didn't know enough about sex in general, let alone gay sex. I probably would have either contracted the virus, which I kind of feel like if that had happened, I probably would still be here today. Mm-hmm. But then there's another side of me that says I might have contracted and not known what I was doing, and it would, because it was so soon, I may not be here today. So I kind of ride the fence either way, but I definitely have that personal, you know, experience around this. So
I think because of my, I've always been a bit of a workhorse.
Yep.
I used to own a magazine called Playland Magazine in San Francisco, which was a club zine. And I had a former record label with my old business partner, excuse me, Keith Harmeyer. Even when I had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, I was just like, okay, just give me the chemo because I have a job. Yeah, I've got a magazine to run. I'm DJing on the weekend. And if I take too many weekends off for DJing, someone's going to replace me.
Yep.
So I think I just sort of stuck a lot of it in the back of my mind and didn't deal with it. And my oncologist was, you know, was very insistent, you need to go see therapy.
Right.
For all my patients who don't, they end up having anxiety attacks. And then it takes a long time to really get control of those. And I'm like, no, 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 I'm Sicilian. We don't do therapy. We just shove it all away. And let it pop up somewhere else. Well, sure enough, within about 6 months after, I thought I was having asthma attacks, and it turned out I was having severe panic attacks.
Wow.
And it took 3 years of therapy, talk therapy, and a little bit of medication to get me over the hump to where I wasn't having them any longer. And that was like a probably a good 5 to 7 year process.
Wow.
And it all had to do with, I didn't really deal with having cancer that could have killed me. I never really dealt with being HIV positive. I was just like, give me the medicine so I can continue to work. And there was family stuff that needed to be dealt with that eventually I was able to deal with in therapy. But there was a lot of things that I just chose to smush down there and not deal with and just continue bearing myself my work until my brain just said, you're going to have to start dealing with this stuff. So now whenever I have a friend who, you know, gets cancer, I always like, I know nobody wants to hear, oh, you should talk to my friend who also had cancer, because half the time you just want to be left alone. I usually just say to them, I'm going to give you one bit of advice. Go to a therapist so that you deal with what's going on in the back of your mind. I said, I'm not going to say anything else other than that, because I didn't. I got the panic attacks and I spent a hell of a lot of money on therapy to get me to where I am today.
Well, I'm glad you're sharing that, Matt, because I think this is a piece that, especially men, so I'm gonna talk to the guys right now that are listening. We love to think we can do all this on our own, that we can figure this out, we can make it happen. It doesn't matter if it's about our sex lives or our relationships or our work or whatever it is. We think we can really make this all happen. And then you get to these spaces of coming out or, you know, confronting HIV and AIDS or cancer, whatever it may be, and we still take our stubborn, dick-headed brains and say, we can make this happen.
Yep.
And it's very rare, very, very rare, and maybe it's because I do this work day in and day out, but it's very rare that I've found that any of us can really do some of this heavy life stuff without a little bit of help. And sometimes a lot of help.
Some support group has to be there.
Yeah, yeah. And it's amazing just being able to either walk into a room or have a close relationship with someone who's been through it. In fact, literally just a couple hours ago, I got a call from someone who is like, I have looked at your website numerous times and I finally decided to make the call because I'm realizing I know I'm in the closet. I have no doubt I'm in the closet. I think I may be bisexual and not gay, but even that's a closet. And I just decided, you know what, might as well talk to somebody that looks like he pretty much has been down the path that I've been. This person happens to be married, you know, is fighting this stuff. And it was really heartwarming because it kind of proves my point. When you can step into those supportive circles, things will start to move a lot quicker and you will feel a lot better a lot sooner.
Absolutely. And I'm excited that, you know, kids can come out a lot sooner and they can have gay groups in high school and gay groups in college that we, you know, certainly could not have had when I was, you know, back there. And for a large majority of kids out there, it's just not an issue. And I think we're going to be a lot better off when all those kids are adults and running things, hopefully, just don't care about it any longer.
Absolutely.
At the same time, it's difficult for people of our generation and older because we went to nightclubs, we went to bar, you know, gay nightclubs, gay bars, gay bathhouses, whatever, because we needed a place that we felt was safe.
Yep.
And where we could go and be ourselves, you know, even if it was just for a couple hours, you know, a night or a couple hours a week. And now the younger generation doesn't need that any longer. They just go where the music sounds good or where the drinks taste good.
Right.
More on the coasts you know, and maybe less, you know, if you're living in like Kansas or Idaho or something.
Sure.
But it's certainly with shows like Glee and, you know, all the other shows out there that had very positive, you know, gay role models on it. I think we're past the tipping point where people are in the minority for making gay kids feel bad about themselves.
Sure. Well, I hope so, because I think it's very critical. What I'm finding is the next kind of gap, so to speak. I mean, yes, we've got the transgender movement that's its own intimate little group of people. And I say little not to be demeaning, but it's its own charge. But here's a group that still is kind of underserved. And it's those people that are in our generation, you know, the 40 plus on up to 60, 70 year olds who... it's hard to find a place where you can go fit in and find your way through this journey, especially if you're still married to the opposite sex, you've got kids, maybe even grandkids, and you just still know in your heart of hearts this isn't who you are. There's not the right, I wouldn't say not the right kind of resources, but there's not resources that a lot of those people can really relate to, because as much as I love our LGBT centers, and I think those that are doing everything they can, they do great work around providing services. But then when you're a 45, 50, 55-year-old person walking in there, you almost feel like you don't fit because you're surrounded by a younger generation getting the help. And I've had numerous clients say, yeah, I went to the center and I couldn't find something that fit for me. This is where we still have some work to do, is finding a way to make this comfortable for our generation.
Yeah, I mean, I do think there is definitely needs to be, for the older generation who needs a place to live, I think there needs to be gay and lesbian retirement communities.
Absolutely.
But as things change, you know, maybe the ones that are existing, as long as they allow people to be who they are. But I think for the older community who has always felt like we've had to keep the rest of the world at an arm's distance, they kind of need a facility for themselves.
Yep, absolutely.
They were actually supposed to build one in San Francisco right next to the Gay and Lesbian Center years ago, and then something fell through and it just became apartments.
Wow. So let's start talking about you. We've talked a lot about the journey and stuff, which I know is part of yours, but you really do make music come to life. You have this beautiful talent of, you know, digital mixing and everything. And I do believe that music is such a part of the journey of coming out and being in our gay life. Now, I don't want someone who's listening to this who happens to be heterosexual to think, well, music's a part of our life too. I'm not saying it's not. But I know, to me, in fact, I still remember this, one of the most important pieces of music for me as I was coming out was Cher's entire Believe album, because that's what was happening when I was coming out. And I remember driving to work and going up and down the coast. I lived in Laguna Beach at the time, and listening to Believe, because that was just kind of the song I just had to have in my heart of hearts. And then, of course, I got the remix versions and everything else. So talk us through, how did you get started in this business? What was the driving force for you?
My cousin was one of the last DJs in New York at Studio 54.
Yep.
Once it was way past its heyday. And he was a head DJ at the Palladium there as well. And I used to go back to New York for at least a month every summer to stay with family. I was always infatuated with New York. And San Francisco reminded me a lot of New York. Once I was of age, I was able to move up there as fast as I could. But I used to go back every year from probably 15 on. And my cousin and I would go record shopping in Manhattan. We'd jump on the train and take it in and go shopping every day. And he basically taught me how to mix music. Music has always been a part of my life. I had, you know, my mother's brother was in a doo-wop band, you know, one of those bands used to stand on the corner and sing doo-wop, and they put a couple records out. And my mom always loved her Ink Spots and her Johnny Mathis. And
right. My
dad was big into jazz and blues. So I was kind of getting it from all ends. And then my older brother, we're all three of us are 3 years apart. My older brother was going through that whole disco, R&B, Commodores Lakeside.
Sure.
But at the same time, you know, Dancy Elton John and Patrick Hernandez, Born to Be Alive. I was kind of getting it from all angles. And once I was in high school, I was big in sort of that stuff I was brought up with, the stuff my brother was listening to. Then I was also getting sort of the Michael Jackson dance side. And then when 80s New Wave hit, I was done. That was, I mean, I was already in love with bands like, you know, Rush and AC/DC and Def Leppard and all the stuff that was happening then. But as soon as 80s New Wave came out, Howard Jones, who's still one of my favorites today, or is my favorite today, Thomas Dolby, Depeche Mode, Erasure, all of that. Suddenly I found the music that really spoke to me. I'm still an 80s fanatic, and I, you know, do an 80s night called Pop Rocks that I started here in Portland. By the time I was about 16, 17, I learned enough to go to work for a mobile DJ, and I was doing weddings and corporate events. And I did that all up through about 92 when I got hit with cancer, and I stopped doing it because I was afraid I was going to screw somebody's wedding up having a panic attack. And I was also waiting until the nightclubs paid more than the wedding work did.
Sure.
So once my career as a DJ, you know, once I was able to get out of San Jose and up to, you know, my Tales of the City, San Francisco.
Sure.
And I was making more than I was making the mobile DJ stuff. That's when things started to take off. And I would take every gig I could. For years, I was the lesbian DJ. I played all the big lesbian clubs would hire me. And because my background in mobile DJing, where you had to play a little bit of everything.
Sure.
From 100 BPM up to 134 BPM and work your way up and down. That's pretty much how you work a wedding with, you know, throwing in R&B and 50s and 60s and current dance stuff.
Yep.
So because I could do a wide gamut of music, I used to get a lot of gigs from the lesbian clubs because that's what they wanted to hear. They didn't want house music all night long.
Right, right.
I slowly got picked up by other clubs, and then I became part of the Gus Presents group. And together we had started the Metropolis Club. And when I left Metropolis after about 2 years, it just happened to be the time when I got a manager. Our record label was putting out these licensed DJ compilations called Circuit Grooves. And those took off around album number 9. And suddenly my manager had me on the road in support of those. I'd leave Thursday and come home Monday. And he would have me, like, you know, Denver on a Friday and Atlanta on a Saturday and Miami on a Sunday or Hawaii on a Friday. And you know, and I was all over the U.S., Canada, and Europe.
Wow.
And that was also back when they paid a lot of money, thank God.
Yeah.
And one of the smartest things I did was I banked all of that DJ money and never touched it. And I lived off of my salary from the record label. And then when all things went into the toilet in 2000 with dot-com bubble bursting, I got together with one other DJ and we bought a 4-unit building in San Francisco, figuring, you know, DJs don't have 401ks, so this is going to be our retirement.
Right on.
I held on to it until last year when I sold one of my units off and bought a home up in Portland.
That's awesome.
Where I moved to because I really wanted to be able to spend all of my time focused on this record label.
Yep.
Because now that, you know, music piracy is 1,000 times worse than it was when Napster came about. It's just not hip to talk about in the news anymore. So I constantly hear people say to me, I mean, people are still downloading music. I'm like, we've had 2 generations now who only know piracy.
Right.
If it's digital, they're allowed to take it for free. And, you know, it makes it very, very difficult for me to pay my artists or pay myself and put these releases out. And, you know, I need to be able to make that money back, and the sales aren't there. And now, you know, streaming makes it even worse. They might as well just be stealing it.
Right.
Because Spotify is paying 0.00004 cents per stream.
Wow.
My artist has to average something like 150,000 streams to make $50.
It's as bad as the book industry these days. Actually,
yeah.
It's worse.
I mean, there's music group services like, say, iTunes and Pandora and RDO and those who actually pay a decent fee. But when Spotify became the world's largest streaming company overnight, they basically said, well, screw this universal price we all came up with.
Right.
We're going to drop it to 0.00004 cents a stream. But then if you're Madonna or Kanye West and you're getting hundreds of thousands of streams, then we'll sort of gauge you up and you'll make more per stream.
Sure.
Well, my artists are never going to have, you know, hundreds of thousands of streams per track.
Yeah.
So we're always going to be stuck at that low fee.
But you've had the chance to work with some pretty cool artists too. I know you've worked with
Absolutely.
Stefani and Lady Gaga and a few other really cool names. So what is the thing that really, from, you know, just being part of that industry and then also being a part of the LGBTQ community, what has that done for you in your gay life? Anything particular stand out?
I love making music and I can't think of doing anything else. Because if I could have, I would have probably stopped a long time ago when you just really couldn't make a living at doing it any longer.
Don't you think that music is such a huge part of our community?
Really
binding us together. I mean, I was 36 when I came out, but it suddenly, like when I came out, I suddenly stepped into a whole new world of music. And I've always loved music. I mean, I played the piano and everything when I was younger. And I love, you know, listening to music, but it's like suddenly there was this whole new world of, wow, all this house music stuff. And then these DJs. And I remember going on my very first gay cruise.
Yep.
And them having, you know, all these great DJs on board. And even though I'm not like a huge house music like guy, I love just being there and being part of it, because I realized it kind of symbolized part of our movement as LGBT people.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember, you know, when I was trying to get my foot in the door with some of those San Francisco clubs, I was going out 4 or 5 nights a week. Thankfully, being a mobile DJ and mostly working on the weekends, I was able to do that. But I remember going to everything from Universe and Pleasure Dome, where I eventually, you know, got what became a resident, but to clubs like Michael Blue's Club Uranus was at the end up on a Friday night and was like my place to go and get lost in the dance floor. And the great thing about the gay dance clubs is you could just go and lose yourself on the floor. You didn't have to dance with somebody else. You could really get lost in the music. And, you know, it took your mind off of everything else that was going on. So I experienced that for many years and thinking, God, this is, you know, the more I was going to, the more I wanted to be that person who was making other people feel that way. So I had to pay my dues and work my way up. And but I mean, it's just there was really no other feeling. And plus, I'm actually, most people don't realize this, but I'm actually fairly shy when it comes to talking to people I don't know.
Right.
So being up on a stage and having that little barrier between me, I love performing. I love seeing the looks on people's faces and getting the waves and seeing people sing along. I'm far less comfortable being on the dance floor and dancing or even just going there with friends than I am to be in the DJ booth and spinning for people.
But you know, I think this is fairly common. I mean, a lot of people, when they meet me, they're like, oh my gosh, you're so outgoing. I'm like, well, not really. I mean, I am, but I'm not, you know. I love doing this. I love being a podcaster. I love speaking on stage, but give me the opportunity to go hole up in my room and just be with myself. I'll take that any day because I like being kind of with myself or just with a tight group of friends. I don't need to be in a big environment. Now, a lot of people would say that's so not true because we see you. Well, that's one aspect of who I am, but the real who I am is kind of that quiet, I wouldn't say introvert because I'm not really introverted, but I just kind of like being alone, you know?
I've always wanted to be more outgoing. I grew up with a family, you know, my family was best friends with another family and they all had kids about our age. And somehow their parents were able to teach them to be able to speak to anybody about pretty much on any topic. And you could sit them in a corner of a room and they could find somebody to have a conversation with. I always envied that because I'm the type, I'll throw a party for a bunch of friends and I'm the one in the kitchen cooking.
Sure.
I'm just so uncomfortable just being out there and trying to mm-hmm. have these conversations. And, you know, music allows me to express myself in ways that I can't just do on my own.
Absolutely. So you're having a pretty good summer, too. I notice you've got a bunch of stuff that's really happening this summer in 2016, the Stefani release and a few other stuff. Anything coming up and going into the fall for you?
We do. We did something we've never done before because this is technically our 5th year for Swishcraft. So I'm going to do a little anniversary thing in the coming months. The end of 2015, beginning of 2016, definitely the general public has definitely become more aware of the label and what we're releasing. And that has also been helped by the fact that my business partner, Robert, who is Division 4, and I have been getting remixes on a lot of major label projects.
Yep.
And we recently had, like, we were one of the only 3 commissioned remixes on the Lady Gaga, Till It Happens to You, Corinne Hanna, Enrique Iglesias, Jess Glenn, Paris Hilton. all of which have shot to the number one position on Billboard Dance. And then we just got on the Gwen Stefani Misery single.
Yeah. So I'm curious, because I'm sure some of the listeners are going to be curious about this too. At least those listeners who can be a little starstruck like I can be every once in a while. So when you're working on a remix, do you ever actually end up interacting with the artist about what they like about it, what they don't like about it, or is it pretty much done through their people, so to speak?
Generally, the record label hires a promotions company.
Yep.
And that promotions company, who we try to keep good communication with, they decide what style of remixes they think they need for the project, and they reach out to those of us who they think can deliver those sounds. So the only time we ever get any interaction with artists is after the fact that it's been out, and if they like it, like Lady Gaga thanked Robert and I and Tracy Young and a few other people who were on that project. She thanked us on her blog, you know, by name, and you know, hashtagged us, sure, which made my Twitter page blow up. And
that's awesome.
Paris Hilton did the same thing. She, you know, she has her Ibiza residency, and she was supposed to debut High Off My Love, just her regular version, and decided to switch and debut ours. Mm. And she announced it on her Twitter that she'd be doing it. And again, our Twitters just blew up. And I've actually never been a big Twitter person, and I finally had to start paying attention to it because it was going crazy. And the combination of doing that mix for Paris, which went to number one, and Enrique Iglesias at the same time, then all of a sudden we started getting other projects thrown to us. But at the same time, you're still calling the few people who give these projects away. And it's like, do you have anything we can work on? Do you have anything here to work on? And let us know who your artists are coming up. Oh, God, I love, you know, Gwen Stefani. Oh, I love so-and-so. Any chance we can get on that project? And there's plenty, plenty of people who are willing to do it for free. So where this used to be a big chunk of our career, everyone's making less and less at it because there's so much bootleg material out. And there's even a few major labels who have stopped commissioning mixes, period. And who have told me flat out, why should we pay you guys to do remixes when there's going to be a glut of bootlegs?
Yeah.
A handful of them are going to be good or great, and we'll just promote those to Billboard because they technically all belong to us since they didn't have permission to do it in the first place.
All right. Well, I would imagine there's a lot of bootleg, you know, artists that are like, even if I can just get the label to like promote my stuff, it makes a name for them, even if it's not a great, you know, even if it's an illegal bootleg name, so to speak. It's like, hey, yeah, my remix got, you know, promoted by the label. So it's kind of a sucky competition, quite honestly.
Yeah, there was just a big conversation on Facebook just the other day between producers in the United States and producers in the UK, because a lot of those guys are still getting paid a decent fee to do remixes, whereas over here, a very tiny minority of people are getting paid still, and the amount is dropping more and more and more. So even the paid guys are throwing out bootlegs.
Yeah.
As they say, the new Ariana Grande, the label just decided they were just going to go with, you know, bootleg mixes and pick the best of them and throw them out there.
Yeah.
That way it doesn't cost them any money. It belongs to them since the vocal and the music and melody belongs to them.
Yep.
And there's nothing that the DJ who bootlegged it can do about it.
Right.
I mean, technically, they could take it and sell it on iTunes and not have to pay the person who remixed it because they didn't have permission to do it in the first place.
Sure.
So we're now kind of in this weird place because we're cutting our own throats and our own paychecks by doing these bootlegs in the hopes that somebody at these labels will listen and say, look, the artsy-fartsy mixes you're doing for these major artists are not getting played in the clubs. They want the type of mixes we're doing. So either use our mixes or pay us to do our mixes, but something has to change, and it's got to change soon.
Well, you know what, Matt? I want to say I'm so glad we had this conversation today on a couple of fronts. Number one, you shared a beautiful part of your life story on your coming out journey, and who you are as a gay man living with HIV, but you also showed the beautiful side of finding that passion in life and really truly living your passion and letting that be your guiding light. And I think for a lot of people that come out of the closet or in the midst of coming out or considering coming out, they think that all that passion and purpose stuff that we talk about so much will never come about. if they come out of the closet. And I personally like to encourage that you're going to be really surprised, because a lot of your passion and purpose may be the stuff that's right there in the closet with you that has yet to be revealed when you show up and truly live who you are authentically as that LGBTQ person. Really appreciate you being here on the podcast with us today, Matt.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Anytime.
Hey, so I always end the episode by asking a question. If you could give one piece of advice to anybody out there listening that's struggling, maybe in the closet, looking to come out, maybe just barely on the other side of the closet, what would you love to leave the listeners with?
Oh, wow. That's a big one. Really just find out what you're most passionate about and follow it.
Yeah.
You know, there's no better job or career in life than the job or career that feels more like a hobby, mm-hmm. because it's fun to do. You're miserable in your job. Find a way to get out of it and follow the thing that makes you happy.
Yeah. That's great advice. And I think that overlays into everything. So many times people come to do the work with me around coming out, and then they're really shocked at how in that coming out process, they end up finding that career or that thing they want to be doing. Well, it's because the coming out piece being hidden away suddenly got broken open. They're like, wow, if I can be this, then what else can I be in my life? And then they're like, oh my gosh, I just got a new job, or I just lost 100 pounds, or they don't realize that this closet we live in is holding back so many different things.
Oh, absolutely.
That we won't really realize until we step through the doorways.
I realize people live in parts of the country where they just, or parts of the world where they just don't have the ability to come out.
Absolutely. Yep.
But either you need to move somewhere where you can, or you got to group up with people and be the voice of change.
Yeah. Well, and I think this is why I feel so compelled and passionate about doing this podcast, is for those people who are living in those places in our own country or across the globe where they feel like they are alone and they have no support.
Sure.
You've got this. Even if all you can do right now is live vicariously through these stories and hear what other people are doing and know that there's possibilities, at least you've got this community. You've got this community where you can lean into. So again, Matt, I really, truly appreciate you. Love everything you're doing. If there's ever anything we can do here on the Coming Out Lounge to promote your stuff, we'll have everything up on the show page about Matt and Swishcraft and all the great stuff he's doing. But if there's anything we can ever do, Matt, and just shoot us a message and we'll get it posted up on our pages.
Oh, I appreciate that. All I have to do is ask that people, visit our swishcraftmusic.com.
Yeah.
And you can check out all the releases that are currently out or coming up. We have quite a few coming up in the next couple of months with Tony Moran, as well as Danny Verdi and Stephen Redant. And go to our Swishcraft page on Facebook and like us.
For those of you listening, it's all right there on the show page. You'll be able to click through to it really easily. And we just want to make sure you really give Matt some love over there. Hey, 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 closet dwellers and Coming Out Lounge listeners. I wanted to invite you to check something out. For all the years that I've been a coming out coach, one thing I've learned is sometimes people come to do the work with me and they only need a little bit of help to get over something very particular and very important to them. It could be reconciling their religion and sexuality. Maybe it's learning how to have the difficult conversations where they say, I'm gay. Possibly it could be, oh my God, I'm out of the closet, but now how do I do this same-sex dating and mating sort of thing? Well, what I can tell you is throughout the years, there are common things that show up over and over and over again. And what I've heard most from my clients and listeners of the podcast is, I want a way to work with you just on these particular subjects. Yay, I am so excited because I've taken the action and I've made this possible. So how do you find out about these particular programs? You go to thecomingoutcoach.com, or if you're on the show page right now listening to the podcast or have just listened to the podcast, over to the right-hand side of the podcast description or anything is an icon that says one-on-one coaching sessions. Click on that button. You'll be taken to a page that describes each of the different 9 sessions I'm offering. They are one-on-one sessions that we can do via phone, Skype, or even FaceTime. They're very action-oriented. We go right to the topic that you want to talk about. And each of these sessions also includes a copy of my book, Frankly, My Dear, I'm Gay. So what more could you ask for? You get me for 90 minutes devoted to you, plus my book. So go check it out. See if there's something that could help you as you step out, step up, and step in to living your powerful truth. Take care. I'm Rick Clemens, the Coming Out Coach. I look forward to working with you.
You've just experienced the Coming Out Lounge. Go online to www.comingoutlounge.com to learn more. And tune in again next week for more stories and tips for being true to yourself.